This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751. Or send in your question through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org.
Last show, we talked about the magic 10% and how to make yourself more attractive. And also, more importantly, what this magic 10% is, which, from what I understand, is that magic time where you find the other person a little bit more attractive than they actually are, and they find you a little bit more attractive than you actually are, and that's where the magic happens. Is that correct?
Sure. That's a very good description, right on target.
Excellent. Yes. Well, we had a great listener turnout last week, and we had a lot of good questions and comments that we did not get to last week, and so we're going to just go through them one by one, and if there's any callers that like to call in, just ask some questions as well. Our phone number here, we are live on Wednesdays at 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. If you feel like calling in, the number is 657-383-0751. So let's just get started here. One of the users asked a very interesting question here. And here's the question. In the last podcast, you talked about how women who are overweight are less attractive than they think they are. But what about age? Older women are less attractive than younger ones, but there's quite a lot of older women who still think they're hot and can get men out of their league for casual sex. Do older women in general have a problem finding a suitable mate due to overrating themselves?
It's a very good question in general, relative to my explanation about weight, the answer would be no. So let me explain that people in general are going to overrate themselves a little bit. That's part and parcel of the nature of human design. So if you kind of want to look behind the wheels of this, all you have to do is to look at any take an NBA basketball game and watch the crowd and watch how partisan everyone is, including the players, about the refereeing. So in 50 years of watching professional sports, I have never had a friend of mine come up to me and said, "Wow, that was really cool. What happened with the game? You know, the refs gave us the game." I've never heard that. Yet 2,000 times I've heard about how the refs robbed our team of the game. So this is clearly an example and one of many that have been investigated in experimental social psychology about how human beings carry around with them what I'm going to call a tipped chip. In other words, they are slightly, the average person is slightly biased in their own direction. And so it's going to be the case that if some girl is a 7, she very likely thinks of herself more like a 7.5 or an 8. Now, I would say that this problem gets accentuated quite substantially because of the fact that women do not actually in their bones understand the impact that excess weight has on the male brain. And the reason why I will submit that is so is because of another social psychological phenomenon known as the egocentric bias. And that is that we use our own mind as a frame of reference for how it is that other people are thinking and acting. So, for example, if you ask people, if you ask people that always go to the dentist, you know, every year, how many people go to the dentist every year? Like 90% of those people will say, "Yeah, I think everybody goes to the dentist." Whereas if you ask people that almost never go to the dentist, how many people do you think go to the dentist every year? They'll tell you, well, almost nobody. So this is the egocentric bias that operates inside of people. And so the very same egocentric bias is going to operate on the female mind, because the female mind does not find men overweight as unattractive as males find female overweight unattractive. And that is because female overweight is mimicking pregnancy, which is the ultimate loss of fertility of a female, and therefore shuts down male sexuality. So from this notion, females can be actually somewhat in the dark about how much their weight is costing them. Now, the listener's question about age would appear to be similar, but it is superficially similar, but it is actually not similar. The reason is that all human beings are very sensitive to aging cues. So we are aware that when we are aging, we are becoming less attractive at a certain point. And now the listener accidentally is tripping over something quite interesting. And that is that it turns out that women are not nearly as sensitive to aging cues as are men. In fact, they are substantially less sensitive to aging cues. In terms of as men age, those cues are not seen by women as unattractive as when females age and men observe their aging cues. Again, this is because that males are really much more sensitive and much more alert to evidence that women are menopausal or postmenopausal, because they need to be tracking female fertility much, much more carefully than women need to be tracking male age. For this point that a male at 55 years old is perfectly virile, but she is looking at his age because she is seeing that he is not going to be as athletic and competent as he was when he was 32. And so she is, in fact, sensitive to those aging cues, but she is not nearly as sensitive to those aging cues as males are. So by the same token, we would expect that female egocentric bias could play into this, that the female might not be privy to this. But however, this is not likely to be the case, because this is going to be a timeless problem of females and males, and females negotiating for males in the mating market across evolutionary time. So it's quite likely that females are, you know, quite keen to the fact that their market value is dropping precipitously as they start to evidence aging cues. So we would not expect to find the same sort of naive narcissism that goes on in aging females as we would see in overweight females. Now, there are going to be, of course, all kinds of exceptions to this rule. So there's going to be plenty of females who, by nature of the normal human minor narcissism, have a little extra dose of it. And so, as a result, they may completely ignore or seemingly unaware of the fact that they have dropped substantially in terms of their mating power. And they may very likely hit on younger or more attractive males and be successful in engaging those males in casual mating strategy, and again take that as evidence that they are in fact higher echelon than they are, when in fact all that's happening is that the males are mining the female's sexual treasury at low cost and low commitment. So undoubtedly that sort of thing happens quite often. It's going to happen to more narcissistic females than more reasonable ones. And so the pattern will be seen, but it will not be, it only superficially mimics the sort of artificial problem that's being thrown at females by excess weight.
Now, so about the casual sex and mating strategy, I was always under the impression that it's way easier for a woman to engage in any type of sex than it is for a man. For example, a woman can just kind of go anywhere and say, hey, let's go, and they can do it. Whereas a man's got to dress nice, he's got to acquire resources, he's got to display the ability to acquire resources, he's got to display the ability to share resources, he's got to have good conversational skills, he's got to be funny, all these other things. It seems to me that it's much easier for a woman to spread her genes rather than a male.
Well, she doesn't spread her genes. That's the whole point.
Okay.
And so, as a result, you're absolutely right. There's utterly no comparison between the sexual challenges of the male and the female. That's true throughout the animal kingdom. That females are far choosier than males are. And that's absolutely true in our species. And so an average attractive female will have no problem finding somebody of her attractiveness that is willing to sleep with her with little or no time invested. And in fact, an average attractive female of our species will have little or no trouble finding a male that is more attractive than her to sleep with her. A male, on the other hand, will have a very difficult time finding someone of his equivalent, and it will be exceedingly difficult for him to find someone who is more attractive than he is to have sex with. And and only will have that happen under conditions where he has demonstrated that he's going to invest a lot. So the male and female live very, very different psychological and lives around these issues, and they're both so close to it that they don't really grasp what is happening on the other side of the fence.
Very, very interesting. Well, this explains a lot. We actually have a caller calling in here. Let's go to the caller here. Just one second here. Hi, caller. What's your name?
Hi, my name is Robert.
Robert, thanks for calling. How you doing today?
Good, good. You know,
Nate and Dr. Lyle. Yeah.
Hey, Dr. Lyle, I just wanted to give a testimonial to thank you. You guys did a show about a month ago about how to agree to disagree. And in the talk, you talked about people have ratios in their head of what they feel is fair. And when you find those ratios, then you can kind of agree to disagree, right? So what I took from that is that I'm a 30-70 person, and I'm in sales. So as I deal with people, now that I know that I'm a 30-70, I've kind of been able to speak up for myself now. And I just wanted to thank you and just kind of share how that's how I took that talk. And it's added a lot of value in my sales, you know, when I deal with customers. So just wanted to give you thanks. And I really enjoyed your TED talk, The Pleasure Trap. Very good talk, by the way.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Hey, that is great. Thanks for calling. And I'm glad you enjoyed that. I'm glad you got some benefit from that. That's just terrific.
Yeah. You know, I had one question. Could you guys maybe, or what are your thoughts on the evolutionary psychology as it relates to branding yourself or the brand effect? Is there a way to, kind of in the new modern way of email and all the new marketing techniques, the evolutionary psychology thinking behind creating your own tribe, which would be branding yourself, and just like a little bit of cool evolutionary background from that.
Yeah, that's very good. You know, there's probably a lot of little pieces to that and I'm not sure it's one thing. So,
okay.
So I think my explanation is going to start going sideways and winding all over the place. So I think that, but if you're interested in that topic, there's an extraordinary book written by a man by the name of Jeff. Can you hear me?
Yes.
There's an extraordinary book written by a man named Miller, and he's an outstanding evolutionary psychologist at the University of New Mexico, and the book is called Spent. And it's the story of evolutionary psychology in the consumer marketplace. And
wow.
So He does. He goes into great detail about a number of very interesting issues in consumer psychology. And as a salesperson, I think that you would find it very, very interesting indeed.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Robert, thank you very much for calling. I really appreciate that. Yeah, thank you for calling in.
No problem. Thank you, guys.
You got it. Yeah, you know, that book with Jeffrey Miller, that's a great book. You recommended it to me a long time ago, and I read it, and it was a really good book. And this is kind of where the personality characteristics come into play, and how different people are kind of operating under different circuitry. And it's essentially the same, but they all have little tiny moving parts that are slightly different, which are the personality traits. So
yes, absolutely. And Miller also does. Yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, Miller does also talk about branding and branding process in there, and at some length. And so it's a little bit of a complicated issue. But for anybody who's interested in consumer psychology, including branding, Miller's book is truly a turning point in our looking and understanding of consumer psychology. It lays waste to previous generations of thinking in the field, and it's going to be increasingly useful as marketing efforts go forward.
Very, very good. We actually have a second caller here coming up, so let's take this call here. Just one second. Hi, caller. What's your name?
My name is Michael.
Michael, hi. You're on with Nate G and Dr. Lyle.
How are you, Dr. Lyle? How are you, Nate?
Good.
I have a general question, maybe kind of a broader question. I've been listening to some of your podcasts and finding very, very interesting. I'm not definitely myself have any expertise in psychology, but I'm aware of the fact that there are multiple fields and areas of psychology. And I'm just curious, if you don't mind, give a little bit of insight in how did you end up in that particular field of psychology, and why do you think this is the kind of able to, why this is able to answer some of the questions that other fields, other theories are not able to answer?
Yes, I mean, that's a very big, broad question. It's an excellent one. So we'll take a few minutes and I'll kind of step you through this.
Let me hang up so I can listen to it on the actual podcast.
Great, very good.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, very good question, which is, sort of how did I wander into this direction, and why am I confident that this method of looking at human behavior is actually the correct one to be looking at it, correct perspective? The reason I'm going to take a broad swipe at this for a few minutes because it's a great question. What we're going to do is we're going to look at a concept that we're going to call consilience. And the concept of consilience was made aware to the intelligentsia by Edward O. Wilson, who is the famous world's leading authority on ants, and the man who developed what we call sociobiology in the 1970s. And he is the great Harvard professor in biology. Now, what Wilson explains about consilience is the notion that the knowledge or understanding of the world that humans have developed is actually artificially segmented. And so, for example, but it's what we're going to call a perfectly nested array, where we have physics on one end of it, and then right next to physics, we would have chemistry. Now, these days we would say, well, there's something in between called physical chemistry. Well, fine, whatever. It doesn't matter. So the point is that the most elemental way of looking at the universe is going to be ultimately, particle physics, subatomic particle physics. And physics has laws about how physics works. And when we move over to chemistry and we look at bigger things, different level of organization of matter, then it's going to turn out that the laws of physics absolutely still apply to chemistry. So there's nothing about chemistry that ultimately cannot be explained in the laws of physics, but we don't actually have to use some of those things because in chemistry we're looking at a higher order of organization. And then the next thing we might look at if we wanted to might be biochemistry. So we're going to look at the chemistry involved in living things. We could have a subfield that we would call that. And no matter what we would find in the laws of biochemistry, they would not violate the laws of chemistry, which would not violate the laws of physics. And then if we were to look at the next level of organization in the universe of living things, biology, we would see that the laws of biology would not violate chemistry or physics. And then we would realize that certain kinds of creatures in the world are not just living, but they actually have brains. They're animals. And what they do is they take in information with sensory systems. They then compute optimal possible behavioral strategies, and then they execute strategies. And so they are animals, and they have brains. And so therefore they have what we're going to call a psychology. And then we have to realize that whatever the laws of psychology are, the laws of psychology have to be consistent with the laws of biology, which have to be consistent with the laws of chemistry, which have to be consistent with the laws of physics. And then when we realize that a certain kind of creature, like a human, actually has social interactions with other humans, that that's part of its nature, we could call that sociology, anthropology, economics, etc. And we're going to find that the laws of those things are not independent of the laws of psychology. But in fact, the laws of economics are absolutely, you are observing the laws of psychology as you watch economic phenomena. And so the laws of supply and demand and elasticity of demand and all the kinds of things that economists talk about, those things ultimately are rooted in human psychology. They're sure as hell not rooted in anything else. And so as a result, we may talk about those concepts in ways where it doesn't seem like we're talking about the psychology of the human organism. But in fact, we are talking about the psychology of the human organism when we're talking about everything, including political science, legal theory, and everything else. You're talking about psychology. So the concept here is one of consilience, that in fact, there's a unity of knowledge that runs through the way the universe works, and we are a living, breathing component of that universe, and our psychology is subject to biological law. Now, no other theory in psychology other than evolutionary psychology is grounding its thinking and its theory in this concept. So Freudian psychology and psychodynamic psychology that's related to Freud is completely like free-floating shamming that have absolutely no connection to anything in biological theory. They pretend to at times. Freud himself was a biologist that had a very feeble, in modern terms, very feeble understanding of life. And so his theories were literally incompatible with our understanding of biology. And other theories in psychology, learning theory, for example, is not grounded in evolutionary thinking at all. So that is why, in the 1970s, when this idea started to very first take hold in theoretical biology. And it wasn't until the 1980s that a very few people started to understand that this was going to be a revolution in our understanding of human nature. And little by little, they started to put together theory and evidence that would support this. It was not officially born until 1992 with the publication of a masterwork called The Adapted Mind by Jerome Barco, Lita Cosmides, and John Tooby. And these ideas were more or less largely born, first in Britain by the evolutionary biologists there, William Hamilton, Richard Dawkins, and people of that ilk. And then it was seeded over into Harvard University, where Edward O. Wilson was studying his ants and developing sociobiology, and Robert Trivers, also a brilliant theoretical biologist, was publishing seminal papers based on evolutionary biology that extended the concepts of evolutionary biology into understanding familial systems, sibling rivalry, and mate choice, and so on and so forth. And so from there, evolutionary psychology was born in the early 1990s. I happened to be a young professor at Stanford University right about that time. And at that time, these people, a whole group of them, John Tooby, Lita Cosmes, David Buss, and out of McMaster's University, there was folks that were studying homicide and child abuse and so on and so forth. These folks came together and essentially outlined how to attack the problems of psychology from a completely brand new perspective, which was using the theory of evolution as their guide. And their successes have been nothing short of breathtaking and spectacular. And so they have laid waste to the last 100 years of academic psychology, largely wherever they've turned their searchlight. And that, and so we have made thousands and thousands of observations that are completely inconsistent with learning theory or psychodynamic theory. But all these observations, as you would expect, are clicking and lining up on a beautiful line. As we now see human beings properly placed in perspective as a great ape, a spectacularly intelligent one, but who nevertheless has thinking, feeling, and behavior, which are consistent with all of the laws of biology, which means they are motivated ultimately by survival and reproductive process. So hopefully that gives people a little bit of background there.
You know, and it's such an interesting concept that there's all these different types of psychological sciences, I guess. And this is the one that makes the most sense to me. And it reminded me a couple of years ago, I had a buddy, a male friend who was dating his I think it was his fiance at the time, but they were dating for a long period of time. And, his girlfriend suggested that they go to counseling because they had some issues they wanted to talk over. And they went to this thing called emotional focus therapy. And he went along with it because he's a nice guy and he wanted to make sure that she was comfortable and that they could have some professional help. And after a few weeks of this, me and my buddies, we sat down with him and said, dude, you're turning into a girl. All you talk about are your feelings and how this affects this and that, the other.
And, yeah, so
that was like one of my first introductions to all the different types of psychological sciences. What's this whole emotional focus therapy? Is that right up your alley?
Well, let's explain. The caller had an interesting question, and he I'm not sure there can be an easy lack of clarity in understanding what we're talking about when we're talking about psychology. Psychology is a subset of what we're going to call neuroscience, and so it's all about the workings of the brain and how the brain works. And so there are people in neuroscience that just study, you know, neurotransmitters and what little neurotransmitter fires from one neuron to the next and how that's organized, so on and so forth. So those are neuroscientists of one ilk. But psychologists are a subset of neuroscience that is really dealing at the level of the decision making of the organism with respect to its adaptive problems for survival and reproduction. So that's what a psychologist is. Now, most people think of a psychologist as some guy talking to somebody on the couch and talking through their problems. That's known as a clinical psychologist. Now, psychology has all kinds of sub-disciplines. So there are developmental psychologists that try to study how children develop. There's personality psychologists that talk about individual differences in personalities. There's cognitive psychologists that are studying problem solving and cognition and language development, and they border on linguists, and they study error tendencies in humans. There's sensation and perception psychologists who are akin to straight biologists that study sensory systems, etc. But when you and I talk about psychology, we're not talking about all those subdisciplines. We're actually talking about, really, when people talk about psychology or psychological schools, they're really talking about clinical psychology. And clinical psychology is the attempt to try to take what is known in, you know, about people, whatever anybody knows about people, and try to apply that to human problems and actually do some good. Now, people have been doing that for a long time. They've been doing it for as long as there's been people. They've been doing it clinically and charging for it as clinical psychologists for 100 years or so. The clinical psychology, when you think about schools like this emotion therapy or gestalt therapy or reality therapy or primal scream therapy or biocentric therapy or cognitive therapy or behavioral therapy, et cetera, okay? what these are is Jungian therapy, Freudian therapy. These are all people that have their own emphasis or thoughts about what causes human suffering and how it is that they can alleviate it. Now, essentially none of them are based on any coherent theory of understanding human motivation and how human psychology works. So some of them are more effective than others because they're less wrong. So cognitive behavioral therapy tends to be more effective than other kinds of therapy for most types of things. But we are now finally standing on firm ground, theoretically, about our understanding of psychology for the first time. And so it's how I got into this was that I was a young academic, psychologist that was trained in experimental social psychology, but trained as a clinician. And then I became aware of evolutionary psychology, and I could see its tremendous explanatory power. And at that point, what I began doing was to learn enough about evolutionary process so that I could start to break down the problems that people were really having and start to try to explain them and see if we could work our way around them by understanding evolutionary process a little bit more deeply with respect to their problems. I found that it is extremely effective in many, many cases where other styles or perspectives on therapy will fail. And so that's what I have spent the last 25 years doing, is developing clinical evolutionary psychology.
Okay, so this is a quite a new topic, and so you know, with regards to my friend who basically was a, you know, what you would describe a typical manly man, started becoming more and more feminine the more he's talking about his emotions and how everything's about his, you know, need to connect and bond, and how he's scared about everything. And the question, I guess, that comes, you know, let's wrap this around to the topic at hand. So that kind of ties into a question of one of the users, one of the listeners, who's basically asks, is masculinity attractive to women because they are feminine? And is it because differences attract each other?
Yeah, let's look at this. So if you are a male, you're designed by nature to look for estrogen cues in females. So you're looking for those estrogen cues both in their bodies, but also in their behavior. So you are absolutely attracted to estrogen. And if you're a female, you are absolutely attracted to testosterone. So you are attracted to, what the genes do is genes, code for different amounts of testosterone or estrogen. And so a man gets a hell of a lot more testosterone than a female gets. And so the average man, for example, has 7 times the amount of circulating testosterone than a female does. And as a result, most of us who are males are not attracted to males because we are not attracted to big muscles. We are simply not attracted to deep voices. And we are not attracted to aggressive behavior, and we're not attracted to using a profanity. And it's going to turn out that all of those things are heavily testosteronized characteristics. Males worldwide will swear 3 times as often as females. And when you see females swear, it alerts you to some testosterone that's in there. And if it's a little too often, a little too much, a lot of males will find that very unattractive. So yes, males and females are attracted to characteristics in the opposite sex that indicate good ratios of testosterone to estrogens. And so we look for beautiful and handsome balances of those chemicals by looking at bodily features and looking at behavior.
Now, are women more attracted to males who swear?
They probably are. In other words, they're, it's, like I said, as it's a worldwide characteristic, of males to swear more often than females, it would be obviously sexual suicide if that were not true. So females are, you know, obviously some guy who's just so foul-mouthed and so aggressive and nasty that nobody can get along with him. Now that's starting to get over the line and too unattractive. But, a male who fastidiously never swears will undoubtedly have a smaller total mating market than the guy who is more normal.
We all know that marks of health are attractive, but how does culture affect attraction? This listener can imagine not indigenous tribe tattoos, but more in the Western world where the set of the symbols are marked.
Yeah, you're all breaking up, Nathan, but I caught just enough of this to some things about other cultures and tattoos and that we are seeking status cues, et cetera.
How's this right now? So the question is, we all know that markers of health are attractive globally, but how does culture affect attraction? For instance, in the Western world, status symbols are like markers of wealth, whereas in some other places like an indigenous tribe, there could be like a tribal tattoo or a particular dance or something like that.
Right. What people are attracted to is going to be what we're going to call fitness indicators. And so animals are evolved to actually be sensitive to certain cues, which could be physical or behavioral, that indicate that whoever is emanating those cues is better than competitors. So we look for example, males worldwide look for the shape of the female form. And the shape of the female form, the curvature shape that men universally find very attractive, these are fitness indicators. They are indicators of exceptionally good ratios of testosterone to estrogens. So high estrogen load females are very attractive to males. And in the same way that females are very attracted to high testosteronized males. So these are fitness indicators because what you're seeing when you see females with good sized breasts, for example, that are well shaped, that men find attractive, what you're actually looking at is you're actually looking at the evidence that the genes that woman has are very good genes relative to her competitors. That's what it is. Now, so behavioral, you don't just look at people, or animals, you watch them. So you're actually looking at their behavior to try to observe whether or not they have good genes. So somebody may look very good, but it turns out that they are uncoordinated and that they're stupid. And it turns out that if you then interact with them or watch them behave, you may find that they are considerably less attractive than they were before. Now, what's actually interesting about this is you'll observe that your ability to essentially make a composite estimate of the person's gene quality winds up being the conglomeration of a lot of independent neural circuits. So you might look at a female who's extremely attractive and may even have beautiful movement, but then when you talk to her, she swears and she's also very stupid. And you'll find that, in fact, you are confused, that there are certain neural circuits inside of you that want to mate with her and certain neural circuits in you that want to get out of the way and get nowhere near her. So you'll literally watch competing demands inside your nervous system as independent neural circuits give you different signals as to what you should be doing about this stimulus. It's the same thing that happens if you have something in your mouth that you're chewing that's tasty and then you hit something that's hard in there. You'll find some of your neural circuits want to keep chewing to get the chocolate, but then something hit a bit of sand and now you have to be careful to protect your teeth. So what we have is we have independent neural circuits that are trying to run composite estimates on the gene quality of individuals. Now, culture is going to come into this in the following way. But in different landscapes, at different times in history, there's going to be different ways that people's behavior is compared against each other in order to determine fitness. So for example, it might have been swimming across a river somewhere where they have a river. But in 21st century America, it's going to be playing basketball, playing football, playing baseball, etc. So we create things, we create contests and tasks which are difficult inherently, so that not everybody can do them equally well. And then we observe the individual differences in people and how they perform these tasks, and we then rank order them according to how good they are at them. And through that, we are able to see into the genetic code and determine which individuals have greater genetic fitness with respect to that section of the genetic code. So that is why you're going to getting a tattoo, for example, is evidence of several things. It's evidence of, for example, that you have the stress tolerance and the pain tolerance to withstand some pain. It's also possibly an indicator of your imagination, so the artistry that is going to be performed on you. It also has been speculated that it is a possible method to demonstrate the high-quality immune system that actually exposes itself by puncturing the skin to possible harmful pathogens, and therefore is a display that one has a good immune system, that you can afford to run that risk and manage to survive. So there's so we're not altogether certain why tattoos may or may not be a fitness indicator, but they are very clearly used as a fitness demonstration, and they are respected as such to some degree. So, for example, if I see somebody with a bunch of tattoos, I'm assuming that they are a little edgier, a little more dangerous, and et cetera, that they're more testosteronized, et cetera. And if I see females with tattoos, I'm also believing that they're more testosteronized. They are a little bit tougher. They're more willing to get punctured. They're willing to put up with some pain tolerance. And they are definitely a signal of greater probability of access as casual mating strategy targets. Which is a, they're indicating a little bit of wildness, which is a niche operating procedure in female mating strategy. So these culture, things change. There's going to be different things in different cultures that are going to be rare. There's going to be different cultures that are going to have different temperature and circumstances. So dances may look different. The costumes may look different. The colors may look different depending upon the local dyes. But what we see around the world is extraordinary universals when it comes to the displays that humans do with respect to fitness in 21st century America and for a long time. The acquisition of wealth, which is not a, which is not actually a natural phenomenon, but it is mimicking a natural phenomenon, which is the taking of territory, and getting wealth is hard to do. So therefore, anything that is hard to do and it could be potentially valuable, like territory, is therefore an indicator of fitness. It took good genes to do it, and there's no question in any reasonable person's mind that people that are making $100,000 a year are, on average, more genetically capable than those that are making $10,000 in the same culture.
And so this is where the question becomes, how much yes. can we fake attractiveness? For instance, for instance, a woman who no. receives breast implants or yeah. Buttocks implants, or men yeah. who are born, shorter, but they wear lifts in their shoes. The question is, does it matter if it's fake or perceived, or does it have to be real? In other words, I mean, we all know that if you get married to somebody thinking that they're tall or they've got big breasts, and then, 2 years later, you find out they are able to somehow hide it. But I'm talking casual mating, or even at least to kind of fake it. Is that possible? And
of course it's possible, but you have to understand that human beings evolved to look for these fitness indicators. So human beings are exceptionally good at smoking their way past any bluffs. So that's, you know, obviously when you hug some woman that you've just met and you're sort of attracted to her, there's a desire to use your fingers as much as ethically possible to actually figure out how much fat she's got on her, what the curves are really like, et cetera. Okay. And don't think that she's not hugging you to see whether or not how much musculature there is in that chest or whether or not that's just a padded shirt and some shoulder pads on a suit. So human beings are designed to be triangulating their attention on fitness indicators. So, if you have a phony diploma, from Harvard Law School on the wall, but when she talks to you within a couple minutes, she can tell that you're average intelligence, she's not impressed with the Harvard Law School diploma. She figures, she doesn't know what happened to you, but maybe you had a head injury at some point, or who the hell knows. But the point is that she's not
good at forgery.
Yes, you're good at forgery. So the point is that of course people try to bluff each other to the level of the detection mechanisms. That's what credit is all about. Okay. You know, you really haven't taken that much territory, but with another $15,000, we make it a Lexus instead of a Camry. And, we'll just go into debt and bluff that we've actually taken that territory. So the, people are absolutely bluffing, in order to be, you almost are forced into it by the fact that the rest of the marketplace is bluffing. So game theory is entering the equation, and this is where, you know, breast implants, you know, go in a cultural rage, and they're here to stay because breasts are a very important fitness indicator for males to observe in females. And as a result, if you can fake them when you don't have them genetically, don't think that, you know, every chick with $5,000 or $10,000 to spare isn't going to be headed towards getting those, if she has small breasts. And the ones with small breasts that are not going for it are a hell of a lot of them are thinking about it and scheming it and thinking about it, and thinking about the cost and the operation, what it'll look like and whether or not there's blood and how much it's going to hurt. And, well, I feel embarrassed because then everybody will know. Yeah, you know, there's a whole host of stuff. And maybe some of them are actually happy with small breasts, but they undoubtedly are. But we see a tremendous pressure on women as they are competing with each other for breast size, and small-breasted women definitely feel at a competitive disadvantage, which in fact they are at a competitive disadvantage. A very interesting field experiments have shown that women with bigger breasts get a lot more attention.
And that's a good point. It seems like there are a great number of things that women can do to fake it.
Sure.
Makeup, perfume,
Hell yeah, all kinds of things are going on. But at the end of the day, this is going to be more important for very short-term casual mating strategy than it's going to be for anything else. Paravant strategy, people are smoking out the truth, and they're not going to be signing on any dotted line in this culture until they've smoked it out. This isn't true, of course, across history. There was a famous incident in the 1600s where some man in England, you know, got married, and then he instantly appealed to the king to give him an annulment, because when he got the wife home and got the clothes off of her, and the hair came off, and the makeup came off, and the clothes came off, and it was like, holy smokes, this isn't even, you know, I've been totally defrauded. Incidentally, this is why we have the word disclosure. So disclosure in contracts is about, hey, let's disclose the dirty laundry. Let's find out what happens once we've disclosed the transaction. This is exactly what a huge deal has been in human history. Guys marrying girls that they never had the clothes off of them. Thank God that's over.
So that's why we'll call date 3 from now on disclosure.
Well, maybe you, but for me, it's more like date 23. I'm a little behind.
Didn't you mention last week that males have it in them to lie a lot? So maybe it's not day 3 for me.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. And day 23, okay, so I'll assure the listeners that but I'm not speaking entirely theoretical, but that even a blind squirrel finds an acorn now and then.
Okay, here's a question from one of our listeners. He says he personally experiences something weird. When he's wearing training pants and a black t-shirt, he gets approached by several women. Sounds like a humble brag to me, by the way. But when he wears a nice button-up shirt that makes his girlfriend melt, approaches him in the same setting. So in his opinion, attractiveness and approachability are not necessarily the same, which is obvious, but it seems like a huge discrepancy. Could it be that showing potential or markers of potential are more attractive than actually living up to the potential, which would be markers of health and status?
Wait a second. Slow down. Let's go back to fitness indicators and let's understand what's happening. So muscles are important fitness indicators for males. So when he's in a situation where he is showing his excellent body, obviously, and because I've been around in shorts and t-shirts and I have never yet been approached. Okay. So this guy's in his shorts and his t-shirts and he's being approached by women, which is extraordinary behavior. And I'm really pissed off at him, but hey, this is how it is. Now, so what he's also, it's going to turn out that is when people are showing skin, they are signaling more availability. So he is signaling by showing off his body, he is signaling that he is essentially on the market for that he's not pair bonded. And so he is signaling sexual advertisement, and females that feel like he's real fancy and would like to get a piece of that DNA, even under casual mating strategy conditions, are making themselves known and available. Now, his girlfriend already has seen him with his clothes off. And if he's with his clothes half off with her striding around, she would be irritated with this because he would be signaling casual mating strategy to other females. So that's not going to be a good thing. Now, when he wears button-up, you know, fancy, more expensive, you know, and conservative dress, he's looking like a pair-bonder. Okay, so it's going to turn out that he's signaling pair bond psychology then, and his girlfriend's all happy about it because she now feels she's already attracted to him, but now he's looking like a nice little pair bonder who's going to stick with her forever. So I think that that's probably a good chance that that's the answer to that question.
And so what you're saying is that at some point, if you show too much skin, you might get arrested. So careful out there, guys. Don't don't just show all your skin.
It turns out, social psychological experiments have shown that females are very sensitive to picking up these cues. And so that they definitely are reading button-up shirts with showing less skin as more resource acquisition males, that these are also males that are going to be more pair bonded and that they're going to be more invested in mates and offspring. And they are reading all those cues just like that. And so that's what's happening now.
I'm going to the clothing store tomorrow. All right. How important, we've got a couple more questions. So how important is attractiveness in the modern dating world? Are we still operating under an assortive mating theory, or is attractiveness really the most important thing these days?
Okay, assortive mating is the notion that people mate with people that are like them, you know, culturally like them, and sort of their IQ and their socioeconomic status and all that sort of jazz. Now, the truth is that attractiveness is enormously important. It always has been, and it always will be. It is more important today than it was 60 or 70 years ago, because 60 or 70 years ago, finances were so important. And actually, I mean, 50 years ago, finances were so extraordinarily important to females raising children that the males' financial capabilities were very important to assess and to consider in making mating choices. So in the old days, if you were an 8 female, you were very likely winding up with, you would take a 6 male with more money rather than a 7 male with less money. That would have been a decision that would have been very common in the 1940s, whereas that decision is going to be much less common today, primarily for the fact that the world is much wealthier, and so we are not under the kind of pressure for housing and food as a single mom that you would have been 40 or 50 years ago. And also the females can earn more money as well. So females are able to exercise mating choice behind lust more than they've ever been before. And so, yes, looks are extremely important. They always have been. And whenever they've been compromised, it's been under pressure from financial, you know, resource constraints. And that's where that enters into the equation. So I forget what the rest of the question was.
They were saying, is it attractiveness really the most important thing these days?
Oh, it's the most important thing. It certainly is the most important thing. However, the way to look at these things is to essentially understand that people are carrying around in their heads thresholds. They have thresholds for attractiveness, thresholds for intelligence, and thresholds for personality characteristics. And so what we call chemistry is really all about whether each party finds the other person physically attractive. Then after that point, people are, depending upon what the mating strategy involved in, whether it's casual mating or pair bond strategy, i.e. long-term mating strategies in humans, personality and intelligence become very important considerations, and therefore people do a lot of assortive mating. In other words, they tend to be with people, you know, similar in smarts, and they tend to be in people with similar personalities. That's how that works. But for casual mating, no. Those are much less important considerations, and physical attractiveness dominates the show. It dominates the show in general anyway, but it dominates it less in pair bonding, that particularly for females, than it does actually. I mean, that is where it for females, looks are become less important in pair bond decisions than they are in casual mating decisions. For males, the opposite is true.
Very, very good.
Yes.
Okay, so we will. Any final thoughts about how to make yourself more attractive? We've got about a minute or so left.
Yeah. Well, work hard, make money, dress in nice clothes, have a nice car, have a nice career, have some cash, and have something intelligent to say. And be respectful and don't be cheap. That's my advice to men.
And do we add going to the gym and try to get as built as you can?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah. I remember, you've only got so much time and energy to so many different things. So distribute your priorities among all of those things in some reasonable fashion, so that you are a good advertisement for your underlying gene quality.
And for females?
Same thing. You're more importance on your physical appearance than your bank account. So don't skimp on the trainer or the gym or the healthy food, you know, et cetera. Do a good job, be in excellent condition, and dress the part that you want. And that's how you do it. And don't jump into bed early. Withhold.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much again, Dr. Lyle, for coming on. We had a good topic. We're going to continue next week. This is how we feel talking to Dr. Lyle here.
Kind of a thing, but I feel better after I got all that off my chest. I feel like a load is off my shoulders. You're good.
Very.
Thank you. Listen to me. I didn't do anything. Oh, you did something.
I did not.
There's something. The load gone. Where is it? I don't know. You're good. Nah. You're good, Doc. You're good. I'm going to begin to touch with you. Just one more thing. If I talk to you and you turn me into a fag, I'm going to kill you. You understand?
Do we define fag?
All right, Dr. Lyle, we'll talk to you next week.
Okay. Thank you. See you soon. Bye.
All right.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.